This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Chapter Ali Imran from the Holy Quran, verses number 29 and 30, recited by Saeed Maliki.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قُلْ إِن تُخْفُوا مَا فِي صُدُورِكُمْ أَوْ تُبْدُوهُ يَعْلَمْهُ اللَّهُ وَيَعْلَمُ مَا فِي السماوات وما في الأرض والله على كل شيء يوم تجد كل نفس ما عملت من خير محضرا وما ويحذركم الله نفسه والله رؤوف بالعباد صدق
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the merciful. Say, whether you hide what is in your heart or manifest it, Allah knows it, and He knows whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth, and Allah has power over all things. On the day that every soul shall find present what it has done of good and what it has done of evil, it shall wish that between it and that evil there were a long duration of time. And Allah makes you to be cautious of retribution from Himself, and Allah is compassionate to the servants.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Here's a look at our top stories this hour. Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei rejects talks with the United States, saying problems with America can only be resolved by letting Washington hold Iranians to ransom. An Israeli man succumbs to his wounds sustained in bombings that hit the occupied Al-Quds earlier this week. And Venezuela's government and opposition sign a social protection agreement as they resume talks on ending the political crisis in the Latin American country. Hello and welcome to your world news, come to you live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you for joining us. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has rejected negotiations with the United States, saying talks with Washington would not bear any fruit. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said Iran's problems with America can only be resolved by letting Washington hold Iranians to ransom. The leader warned that in order to put an end to antagonism, the U.S. wants Iran to abandon its nuclear program, change its constitution, and restrict its influence within its borders. Ayatollah Ali Khamenei added no Iranian can accept such conditions. He made the comments in an address to a group of Basij force members in the capital, Tehran. The leader said the Basij force should be well aware of the country's main enemy, that is, the global arrogance. Ayatollah Khamenei added that the enemies are trying to spread lies and fake news and paint a dark picture of Iran. That's because the U.S. wants to dominate the minds of the Iranian people. Ayatollah Khamenei referred to the victory of Iran's Islamic Revolution in 1979 and said the revolution tipped the balance against the arrogant powers in West Asia, dealing a heavy blow to their colonialist policies. The leader added the creation of the usurper Israeli regime was in line with those policies to maintain dominance over the region. Hakima Saghoyebiria is an academic and political analyst. She joined us earlier with her take on the speech delivered by the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution on the occasion of the beginning of Basij Week.
When you look at U.S. history of relations with other countries, you see that the United States looks at the countries around the world in as one of two cases. One is a client country and the other is an enemy country. An enemy is a country that systematically acts independent of the United States, doesn't want to give ransom to the United States, and looks for its own interests rather than trying to take care of the interests of the United States in its region. That is the role that the clients play. Now, Iran, with its revolution, became one of the main enemies of the United States. That is not what we did, but that is what the United States eyes, Iran becomes an enemy just by having a revolution that makes it independent. So here, there are two scenarios. One is that a country is weak enough for the United States to be able to overthrow it, as you know the United States has done in some countries where they had revolutions. For example, in Congo, they had a revolution. They had an independence from the Belgians. And then over a period of 1 year, you know, they had a coup, and they removed Patrice Lumumba, and they killed him, and everything was over, okay? And they had a friendly government, so to speak. But sometimes you have a country like Iran, which is more resilient, that doesn't, you know, old tactics sometimes don't work. So you need to have a step-by-step and a more hybrid scenario for dealing with that country. And that is what has happened with Iran, that from the beginning, many different, you know, instruments have been used. One of them is negotiations, so to call. But I would like to say that it is not negotiations, but it is coercive diplomacy.
An Israeli man has succumbed to injuries he sustained in rear bombings that hit the occupied Al-Quds earlier this week. The death brings to two the number of Israeli killed in the attacks that also left 13 others wounded. On Wednesday, two explosions hit bus stops in the city that security forces said were detonated remotely. No group has claimed responsibility for the attacks. The bombings came amid a spike in violence, which has claimed the lives of 6 Israelis and 14 Palestinians this month across the occupied West Bank. A member of the Israeli Knesset is escalating tensions in Al-Quds City and the West Bank by calling for extrajudicial execution of Palestinian resistance leaders. This comes in the wake of the two bombings in Al-Quds City. The double bombing was the first in the city in years.
Itamar Ben-Gvir, a far-right member of the Israeli Knesset, has called for the extrajudicial executions. He is now to become Israel's Minister of National Security, giving him much more power than he had before. That power is quickly turning into a tool for him to pursue his extremist anti-Arab agendas. Just to put the extremism into perspective, Ben-Gvir and his allies hope to grant total immunity to Israeli soldiers who shoot at Palestinians and also impose the death penalty on Palestinians who attack Jewish people. For even more perspective, he made the headlines just before the Israeli elections as he called on the police to shoot Palestinian stone throwers as he held a pistol in his hand. Now being in charge of the Ministry of National Security, he has the power to implement his racist agendas that he's been advocating for years. Ben-Gvir's far-right party is called Otzma Yehudit, which translates into Jewish power. This party also has been fittingly called Kahanist and anti-Arab. Kahanist because the members of this party owe a lot of their racist ideologies to a racist rabbi by the name of Meir Kahane. He had called for a ban on Arab-Jewish intermarriage as well as mass expulsion of Palestinians. His ideas were in fact so repugnant that the US listed his party as a terrorist group, and he was even banned from Israeli parliament, the Knesset. He was unsurprisingly assassinated by an Arab in 1990. His ideologies, however, live on as Itamar Ben-Gvir recently paid his tribute at an annual memorial still held to this date to revive the Otzma Yehudit party's pledge of allegiance to the slain Jewish supremacist rabbi.
He never since disowned Rabbi Meir Kahane or his legacy. In this passive regard, he's part of that racist legacy, but he was never caught saying anything like that publicly himself. That is why he remains within the political arena, and in recent years also much more firmly within it.
While Ben-Gvir was booed by the audience for saying, "I am not Rabbi Kahane and I do not support the deportation of all Arabs," he did also say, "Ultimately, Rabbi Kahane was about love. Love for Israel without compromise, without any other consideration."
He was cheered later for vowing to expel what he called terrorists from Israel. With his newfound power alongside Benjamin Netanyahu and his Likud party, Israel is expected to have its most religious cabinet to date, which in Zionist terms means the most extremist Israeli administration to date.
Fears are growing over how this new Israeli administration, whose security now falls under the reins of a deeply problematic zealot, can worsen the tensions in Al-Quds and the West Bank. Tensions that have already been on the rise as a result of expansion of illegal settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories. The twin blasts further expose Israel's security lapses.
We know that tensions are going to be heightened with the installment of Ben-Gvir from his most recent visit to the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the city of Al-Quds. During his visit, protected by Israeli police, he shouted that we are the masters of the house here, almost to provoke a response from Palestinians. But Palestine isn't scared. Israel, however much it tries to portray itself as an impenetrable fortress, has never known peace since the occupation began in 1948. Even though it has struck normalization deals with certain Arab nations, trying to dethrone the issue of Palestine as the number one concern in the Muslim world, and even though it is backed to the hilt by the US and EU, whether politically or militarily, Israel is far from the safe haven it likes to portray itself as being. What has been happening in the occupied West Bank, with Israel's efforts to repress protests with brutal violence, indicates that the Palestinian liberation struggle is entering a new phase, when once extremist fringe settlers are now seeing themselves represented at the top levels of Israeli administrations and are backed by the police, they become emboldened and extremely brash and out of control. Neighborhoods in Al-Quds have seen Palestinians burning tires and dumpsters and throwing firecrackers at raiding Israeli forces and even lighting police vehicles on fire. The complete immunity of Israel and the empty gestures by international bodies is pushing Palestinians into a full-scale revolt, a third intifada perhaps. If that were to happen, Israel's luck might just run out this time in their effort to save face on the international sphere, and if they do lose face, the conflict will take a very different shape.
Pakistan's former Prime Minister Imran Khan and his supporters assembled near Islamabad on Saturday, urging the government to step down and to hold fresh elections. In his first public address since being shot in an assassination attempt earlier this month, Khan vowed to fight with his, quote, last drop of blood. Nasser Kazmi has more.
Tens of thousands of activists from Imran Khan's PTI party, who came from all across Pakistan, chanted anti-government slogans demanding immediate elections, accusing the government for what they called following U.S.-backed policies. The protesters held the ruling party responsible for the current economic crisis. They said Imran Khan is the only leader who could bring political and economic stability to Pakistan.
Our leader Imran Khan is fighting with the corrupt mafia who was brought by the U.S. Our struggle is for the rule of law in the country, and that is only possible when Imran Khan will be in power.
Having survived an assassination attempt during his anti-government march on the 3rd of November, former Prime Minister Imran Khan joined the protesters in person for the first time in 3 weeks amid stringent security. Khan told his supporters that although his life is under threat, he will continue his political struggle until his demands are met.
This imported government was brought to a U.S. conspiracy for corruption purposes. We will not accept this puppet regime and we will fight till the end for fresh polls. We will dissolve our provincial governments in Punjab and Khyber Pakhtunkhwa provinces in days to come.
While calling Khan's long march a flop show, the government says that it will complete its constitutional term and the electoral process will be held at its scheduled time. Imran Khan's supporters say the recent massive mass rallies indicate Imran Khan's increasing popularity in his political domain. However, it is highly believed that his party will face tough political competition if the scheduled general elections are held according to the government's plan. Nasir Kazmi in Islamabad.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-un says his country's ultimate goal is to possess the world's most powerful nuclear force. Kim called for the limitless bolstering of Pyongyang's defense capabilities. He described building the country's nuclear force as essential to protecting the dignity and sovereignty of the state. Kim and his daughter were at an event celebrating the launch of Pyongyang's newest intercontinental ballistic missile. The missile, called Hwasong-17, was successfully tested on the 18th of November and is believed to be capable of reaching the U.S. mainland. Kim hailed the new ICBM as the world's most strategic weapon. South Korea and its Western allies have been warning for some time that the North is preparing to conduct its seventh nuclear test. The Venezuelan government and opposition groups have reached an agreement as the two sides resume talks on ending the political crisis in the Latin American country. The accord marks a breakthrough after 15 months of stalemate between President Nicolas Maduro's government and his opposition. It focuses on education, health, food security, flood response, and electricity programs. The agreement paves the way for the UN to oversee a trust fund of frozen assets of the Maduro government to be used for a variety of social projects in Venezuela. Maduro's opposition is seeking free and fair presidential elections next due in 2024. While Caracas wants the international community to recognize Maduro as the rightful president and to lift sanctions mostly imposed by the U.S. Italy's bakery industry is experiencing severe difficulties as high inflation and surging power bills continue to bite hard on the sector. Trade associations are demanding the government help them tackle rising production costs, a problem they have faced since the start of the conflict in Ukraine. Max Civilli has more from Rome.
Bakeries from around Italy have warned the government that their activities are at risk of shutting down if they won't receive financial help as soon as possible. Trade associations and representatives of the bakery industry met the Business and Made in Italy Minister Adolfo Urso on Friday to demand subsidies and safeguard measures to tackle the dramatic rise in the cost of raw materials, such as flour, diesel oil, packaging and equipment.
Flour has gone up from around 4.5 euros per kilo to around 8 euros. The cost of mozzarella has gone up by 30%, that of tomatoes has doubled, and the same goes with cost of equipment. The government must do something to save bakeries, as we are disappearing. The quality and freshness of products from small specialized stores like ours is hard to beat.
Smaller family-owned bakery shops in Italy are slowly disappearing, giving place to large supermarkets. A cost-of-living crisis, rising inflation and energy prices have badly affected many of the around 26,000 bakeries, which employ about 100,000 workers across the country. Power bills have doubled in Italy over the past months amid the energy crisis sparked by the Ukraine war. This is while the country's annual inflation rate was almost 12% in October, the highest level since March 1984.
All prices have increased a lot. The cost of energy, raw materials, everything has gone up by at least 40%.
Prices have gone up also in supermarkets where there is no more food in offer. But where prices have gone insane is at work. I am employed by a communication agency and the quotations we receive have doubled.
Earlier this week, the Giorgia Meloni government announced its draft 2023 budget bill, which includes measures aimed at channeling 35 billion euros towards families and businesses in order to ease the burden of high inflation and power bills. Many fear these measures will do little to shield the Italians. Max Civili, Rome.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en. On Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, Thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
In the limelight. Saudis are hiding many stories about the situation of human rights in their country. According to reports, there are hundreds of political prisoners languishing in the dungeons of the Saudi kingdom, which Mohammed bin Salman does not wish the world to know about them. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Crescent International noted, while the Saudis are reveling in their team's freak victory over Argentina in Doha, Qatar, there is an even more important story that needs recounting. There are hundreds of political prisoners languishing in the dungeons of the medieval kingdom. The de facto ruler Mohammed bin Salman, known as MBS, may not wish the world know about them, but they must not be forgotten. Just as the Saudis were celebrating their victory on November 22nd, and not likely to be repeated, the date coincided with completion of the 10-year sentence of human rights activist Professor Mohammed Fahad Al-Qahtani. Yet, he has not been released. Instead, he has been moved to another prison, but his whereabouts are not known even to his family. Dr. Mohammed Al-Qahtani's prison term has expired, and he has not been released. Adel Al-Said, an activist with the European Saudi Organization for Human Rights, was quoted by Middle East Eye as saying, Al-Qahtani is a professor of economics and a political activist. His sin was that he was one of the founding members of the Saudi Civil and Political Rights Association, ACPRA. The organization has since been disbanded. Professor Al-Qahtani and co-founder of the organization, Abdullah Al-Hamid, were arrested in 2010. They were handed 10 and 11-year prison sentences, respectively. What was their crime? They were accused of breaking allegiance to the ruler, questioning the integrity of officials, seeking to disrupt security and inciting disorder, and instigating international organizations against the kingdom. These allegations are bizarre. Is allegiance to the ruler compulsory? As for the integrity of officials, one only need recall the brutal murder of Jamal Khashoggi in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in October 2018. Saudi officials, on orders from MBS, not only murdered Khashoggi in cold blood, but also chopped his body. It is widely believed that the body was then dissolved in acid. It has never been recovered. Al-Qahtani's family was naturally looking forward to his release after he completed his sentence. His wife, however, altered human rights activists more than 20 days ago that the prison administration had prevented him from communicating and transferred him to another unknown location. In prison, Al-Qahtani was being harassed by other inmates. When he submitted a complaint to the prison authorities, Al-Qahtani was transferred to an unknown location, according to ESOHR. His fellow co-founder of ACPRA, Abdullah Al-Hamid, died in prison in 2020. He had suffered a stroke 2 weeks earlier, but was kept in detention despite being in a coma at the hospital. Several other founding members of ACRPA are also behind bars, including human rights lawyer Walid Abu Al-Khair and Mohammed Al-Bajadi. The latter was detained without charge or trial in 2018 and remains behind bars. Adel Al-Said of ECOHR said that Saudi Arabia was not releasing political prisoners even after they had served their prison term. These include Muhammad Al-Rabaya, Isa Al-Nokefi, two other activists who served their terms but have not been released, according to Said. While the Saudi regime has always been brutal towards those demanding basic rights, the campaign of oppression has intensified since the ascent of MBS to power. scored of academics, human rights activists, lawyers, preachers, economists, and women's rights activists have been arrested and languish in prison. There is no codified law in Saudi Arabia. The whim of the presiding judge passes for law. Judges are notorious for pandering to envious wishes. They know that any person who has been arrested has clearly run afoul of the Crown Prince. They are sentenced to harsh prison terms. Even lawyers defending clients have been sentenced to prison for the temerity of defending the accused. Such well-known figures as Salman al-Awda, Ali al-Omari, and Awad al-Gharni are facing execution. They did not kill anyone. They simply called for peace between fellow Muslims. The case of Sheikh Salman al-Awda is instructive. In September 2017, Sheikh Salman al-Awda had prayed for reconciliation between Saudi Arabia and Qatar. This was soon after MBS cut off relations with its smaller neighbor and imposed harsh sanctions on it. In January 2021, MBS made up with Qatar and invited the Emir, Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani, to Saudi Arabia. Relations have been fully restored. MBS even attended the opening ceremony of FIFA World Cup on November 20th and was warmly received by Sheikh Hamad. So, why is Sheikh Salman is still in prison and facing the death sentence? This is what Saudi Arabia, a society ruled by savages, is all about. According to Press TV, hawkish Republican Senator Tom Cotton has agreed with the Biden administration's decision to grant sovereign immunity to Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman over journalist Jamal Khashoggi's 2018 murder. What the administration has touted this week is granting sovereign immunity to Mohammed bin Salman is in keeping with the practice of custom of lawsuits involving foreign heads of state, Cotton told Fox News recently, adding, "It would have been a major break if those customs did not grant that kind of immunity." The U.S. State Department recently gave bin Salman immunity from the lawsuit despite Joe Biden's earlier promise to hold the de facto Saudi ruler accountable for the crime. Citing its constitutional authority as well as customary international law, the State Department said, "Prime Minister bin Salman, as a sitting head of government, is immune. While in office from the jurisdiction of the United States District Court is in this suit." Amnesty International recently condemned the Biden administration and called the act a deep betrayal. Amnesty Secretary General Agnes Callamard said in a statement, "The U.S. government should hang its head in shame. This is nothing more than a sickening, total, deep betrayal. First, the evidence of the Crown Prince's involvement in Jamal Khashoggi's murder was disregarded by President Trump, then President Biden's first bump. It all suggests shady deals made throughout." The U.S. intelligence community previously concluded the killing of Khashoggi, a Saudi dissident, was ordered by the Crown Prince, but Cotton claimed other regimes had done worse and that Washington could not be too fastidious with its foreign partners. Cotton said on Fox News, "Saudi Arabia's far from the world's worst abuser of human rights. Look, if we didn't have allies and partners who don't always share our political systems or our cultural and social sensibilities, we wouldn't have any allies and partners," he said. Khashoggi, who was murdered and dismembered by a Saudi hit squad at the kingdom's consulate in Istanbul on October 2, 2018, used to be a vocal critic of the Saudi regime and the Crown Prince. According to reports, he was lured into the diplomatic mission under the pretext of being provided with papers for his wedding. He was suffocated and dismembered while his fiancée waited outside for him. Biden vowed during his presidential campaign to make Saudi Arabia a pariah following Khashoggi's killing, but he reversed course in July as he traveled to the country and gave a fist bump to Ben Salman. Fred Ryan, the publisher of the Washington Post, has blasted Biden for both the trip and the recent move to grant the Crown Prince immunity. Ryan wrote of Biden, "He is granting a license to kill to one of the world's most egregious human rights abusers." Cotton said that federal laws have changed to allow U.S. citizens to sue governments that sponsor terrorist attacks, but he pointed out those changes don't apply to the Khashoggi case. When you're talking about individuals who are at the head of a foreign government, it's been customary for decades to grant them immunity, Cotton said, so it would be a major break in another effort in the campaign to alienate and ostracize Saudi Arabia not to recognize this traditional kind of immunity, Cotton claimed. Later in the program, Senate Intelligence Committee Chair Mark Warner said he agreed with Cotton's claim, saying the reason why there was a grant of sovereign immunity even to leaders we don't like is as much to protect American leaders and American diplomats when they're posted abroad from being subject to Saudi Arabian law or South African law, Warner told Brim, adding, so this has been historical precedent. Saudi Arabia initially issued conflicting stories about Khashoggi's disappearance, but eventually said he had been killed in a rogue operation. Despite denials by Riyadh's regime, some Western governments and a spy agency said the Crown Prince had ordered the assassination, causing a global uproar.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Maryam and Masood Rajavi.
اونجا اصرار داشتن که این موضوع مطرح کنن که بایستی نفری که
They were insisting on claiming that a person who drops out should be given a death sentence. I wanted to talk in this regard, so they allowed me. I said that yes, this is a betrayal. He asked what we should do to them then. He wanted me to say that we should kill them, but I couldn't say such a thing.
Then the American war against Iraq started.
بلافاصله بعد از اینکه صدام حسین سقوط کرد و آمریکای عراق اشغال کردن.
A few weeks after the fall of Saddam and the occupation of Iraq, I saw the news of Mariam's arrest in Paris on the canteen's notice board. Many of the guys had gathered, reading the same article. We were all shocked. Our first thought was, who exactly was this Mariam, written in the article that read, "We call for the French government to provide security for Mariam, the leader of the resistance." Since we were under the impression that Mariam was in Iraq with us under the bombardment, that was actually what Massoud had told us. Unit commanders and higher-ranking officers were assembled and scolded as to why they were sitting idle while they were witnessing many of the members performing self-immolations in Europe and elsewhere in the protest. Although I was upset that Mariam had betrayed us and left us, my sense of loyalty was strong, and I volunteered to take part in self-immolation.
زنانی بودن که از بیمارستان می آمدن و بچه ها می رفتن.
There were women who would return from hospital and were said to have undergone an operation called the feminine operation.
افراد اول که شما بخاطر.
They would encourage women to undergo this surgery, saying that, for instance, you have kidney problems or that you have anemia. They'd remove their uterus and ovaries so they could no longer hope of having a family in the future.
We would take part in sessions in which everyone had to insult one another. Cursing. I remember the first time I took part in these sessions monitored by Pari Bakhshayi. We were told everyone should confess to the things they had done. Some people stood up and talked. People had to fabricate lies in the sessions so as not to suffer consequences later. One of the guys stood up and said, "I took part in a private talk," meaning that he had had a chat with someone about something about the issues of the organization. It was then that I felt for the first time that these ceremonies made me feel nothing. This was the first spark that later convinced me to escape. But at that time, I still liked Massoud. I could see the wrong and ridiculousness, but I would think that perhaps Massoud and Mariam don't know what's going on here.
I was forcibly taken to a 150-member meeting of the women of the Leadership Council. As I was resisting sitting on that chair, because I refused to sit on that chair, they pushed me down and pulled my hands down. There was a woman who kept pushing me down on the chair so that I would sit calmly and listen to the speeches.
درد گردنم شدید بود قبلشم گوشم پرده گوشم از سمت چپ پاره شده بود.
I had a really bad pain in my neck. Prior to that, my left eardrum had been torn. They hadn't taken me to an Iraqi specialist.
دکتر عراقی منو نبرده بودن، یعنی دکتر متخصص.
I was taken to one of the ordinary GPs of the organization, and my simple ear infection turned into a torn eardrum.
گوش درد ساده باعث شده بود پرده گوشم پاره بشه.
Then they did what they shouldn't have and carried out an ear irrigation. And that's when the infection entered my internal ear.
اینا همینطوری چرک و فونت از گوشم می‌ریخت. دکترها خود اونا هم گفته بودن باید بری دکتر.
Even their own doctors said that I should go to an Iraqi doctor, and they knew that my ear needed an operation.
من یه پنبه تو گوشم گذاشتم.
I had put a piece of cotton wool in my ear so that the screams and cheers of the people in the meeting wouldn't hurt me so much.
انجام میدن کمتر اذیت بشه گوشم.
در اونجا یکی از این خانم‌ها.
There was one woman who was provoked by the higher ups and who was actually one of the torturers by the name of Faize Mohabbat Kar. She pulled the cotton wool out of my ear and shouted in it, "What kind of a sick person are you for resisting so much?"
One of the members said, "I don't want to talk." Masood Rajavi loudly shouted, "Who the hell are you to decide?" and some other words. This was the first time I was hearing such words from him. He shouted some curse words. The whole gathering was dead silent out of fear.
It had been years since we had had news of our families, for instance, our mothers and fathers. We weren't given news of them. They said that you should give a written guarantee that you would no longer rest in sleeping quarters and that you would no longer think about anything but Masood and Maryam. They said that your goals and dreams should be Masood and Maryam only and that your leader is Masood Rajavi. You should direct all your affections towards Maryam and Masood Rajavi. To win our hearts and to deceive the women, Masood Rajavi presented the women of the Leadership Council and the trial members of the council with a gold necklace, with a pendant, with his image carved into it. He said, "Wear this to remember me all the time. You should have me in your hearts and you should give me your affection."
Just a few days after my back operation, I was ordered to take part in a campaign meeting. I told them that I'm still hospitalized, but that wasn't a good enough reason for them. I attended, but after a quarter of an hour, I fell sick and I was allowed to leave. This was the type of torture, the kind of which I haven't seen elsewhere. To force you to attend in a mental torture session while you are being physically tortured as well.
We, the women, were even afraid to go in front of the mirror in each other's presence. If one of them saw us looking in the mirror, they might even report us to the authorities, saying that she is seen in front of the mirror a lot. And why would they care about that? Well, because if we cared about our looks, it meant we cared about our future. And if we thought about our future, then that meant that we wanted to leave the organization someday.
We went there with a certain motivation. Our intentions were not bad per se. We were thinking that with their beautiful slogans, we were going to serve our country. And with the religious ideologies that we had, we were under the impression that we were walking along the same path and in the same direction as such historical heroes as Bagher Khan, Sattar Khan, Amir Kabir, and Mirza Kuchak Khan, and Dr. Mossadegh. Only the passage of time made it clear that the fight of Masood Rajavi was not for the freedom of the people, but rather for power. This is what Maryam herself confessed in one of the meetings. So it's not something I'm making up. Maryam said that it was Masood's right to become the leader of Iran and not Ayatollah Khomeini.
The Red Cross came to visit the camp. We were briefed and told that we were to tell the Red Cross reps that the Islamic Republic tortured our families. The person who was in charge of me by that time was familiar with my defiant nature. She came to me and she sympathized with my pains and ailments a little, but in fact she was keeping me under her watchful eye during the meeting.
According to the Fourth Geneva Convention, we were considered protected citizens. When they wanted to announce this, they set up a general gathering, and there we got to see and mix with our other friends. We mentioned our escape plans. First, we wanted to escape 2 days after, but then decided to do it on the third day because we were worried they would keep us busy with meetings and gatherings of some sort. It was there that I made my final decision and said yes. We made plans to meet next to the podium, which was next to the driveway where Masoud and Maryam took position during the parades and speeches. The driveway would lead to where Americans were deployed in Ashraf since the occupation.
My commander called me into her room. I refused to go, saying that now in this critical situation when I was going to meet the Red Cross reps, they were calling me into a room. No way. I had noticed that they were frightened I would do or say something, so they decided to remove me from the situation. They couldn't take me away forcefully in front of the Red Cross reps.
We all got into a car and drove towards the Americans, all the while fearing that they might catch up to us. We reached the Americans and they took us in. I should also point out that the place the Americans had dedicated to those who had separated from the MKO was not a nice place. It was like a detention center. Prior to that, we had heard many horrible things about this place from Mujahideen, saying that this place is horrendous and that people get killed or raped in order to deter us. But we had got to the point that we could no longer take any more of their lies, and we knew that remaining there any longer was a sin.
Zohra Qaimi said, wrap up the session. As they wanted to finish the meeting, I raised my hand and said that I wanted to talk. I had made up my mind to leave the organization, and now was my best chance for me to talk with the Red Cross reps. By this time, the women of the Leadership Council started throwing around the chairs, and they caused such a chaos that none of us could say anything to the representatives of the Red Cross.
Three months prior to this, the Americans had already interviewed us. I had already told them that I wanted to leave the organization and Ashraf. By then, they all knew because so many had requested the same. They would ask, do you want to stay in Iraq or go to the U.S.? And they said that they would help us reach our desired country in a few months' time.
They caused chaos to distract the Red Cross representatives and then to take me away from the venue. But I moved towards them. One of the Red Cross members even stretched her hand out, trying to protect me, and I managed to reach her.
At that time, they had managed to make a pact with the Americans, threatening that if they took us away, it would be bad for both sides. Because the MKO was providing the Americans with needed intelligence, they claimed it would be bad for them because we would give their intelligence to the insurgents fighting against the Americans.
The Red Cross representative sat me down on a chair. I whispered to her, please take me out of here with you. They have tortured me and have taken me to many torture sessions. And now if you don't take me with you, I will have no chance. They have some sedative injections that they will apply to my neck. They will make me unconscious, and I'm sure they will then kill me.
حتما اینها بیهوش میکنن و بعد منو میکشن، شما متوجه نمیشین.
تازه اون زمان که فکر کردیم آزاد شدیم از دست مجاهدین، تازه افتادیم.
When we thought we had finally been freed, we ended up in the custody of people who were being served by the MKO. However, we still preferred this to being involved with the Mujahideen.
با من صحبت کردن، گفتن که تو نگران نباش.
They told me not to worry and that now that I had talked to them I was safe.
آزاری نمیرسونن با فردا.
And they told me they would return to talk to me more extensively the day after.
صحنه بودش که اینا گفته بودن جلسه تموم شده.
Because at that time the session had already come to a close. I begged them to take me with them, but they said they couldn't do that.
In 2007, the Americans at last allowed us to leave there in groups of five. And finally, we were set free to go and live our lives in the outside world. It had been years that I wanted to walk on the streets of a city. When, after 22 years, I could walk for the first time on the open streets and on the pavements and asphalt of somewhere that was not a closure, I had a strange feeling. It was euphoric.
I had two doctor's appointments, one for my ear and one with an orthopedist. Although the doctor's offices were in an Iraqi neighborhood, the organization had the situation completely under their control. I told myself, Zahra, you either die here or you have to escape. You cannot return to Ashraf camp alive. I went to the kitchen and saw that the windows were closed, sealed in a way that they could not be opened in any manner.
توی لحظه متوجه شدم که اینها رفتار منو مشکوک تلقی کردن. اومدن گفتن که
They had become suspicious of my behavior. They asked me to join them and sit down on a chair.
همونجا رو صندلی نشستم، دیدم مطمئن شدم که اصلا
I did as I was told because I knew that escaping was out of the question.
بعد منو صدا کردن که نوبت قرار من هست.
Then I was called in for my appointment. I took my ear file and entered the Iraqi doctor's office.
رفتم وارد اتاق دکتر عراقی شدم.
My interpreter there was a woman who was among the women of the leadership council.
همینطور تو ذهنم داشتم نقشه می‌ریختم که چگونه از لحظات استفاده کنم.
All the while I was analyzing the situation in my mind to see how I could take advantage of the slightest opportunity if it presented itself. They wanted to make the situation seem normal, so they called out, "Let's go."
گفتن بیاین بریم. تا من فقط همینو ثانیه ها بودش تا برگشتن.
But then, as they turned their back on me, all this happened in a matter of seconds. I opened the back door and ran out.
در پشت رو باز کردم، فرار کردم.
اولین روزهایی که خارج شده بودم از اونجا هنوز احساس می‌کردم که من نباید
During the first days that I was out I still had this feeling that I shouldn't be thinking about my life and finding love. I was now away from the cult but was still thinking that I was not entitled to these things.
مریم رجبی که هیچی
Neither Maryam Rajavi nor any other power can ever hold some people in a closed environment. Masoud Rajavi used to say this himself, and now we should remind him of it again. He used to say, "No power can keep people in chains forever." Well, we should tell him the same thing now. No matter what you do, people who want to will get out one day. One day the chains will break off and the doors will open up. I wish you would stop all your cruelties and corruption and deceit, at least against your own people, and let them come out and see the world for themselves, to finally realize that what you had inflicted upon them were lies.
In the limelight.
Majority of the Republican candidates supported by Donald Trump failed to reach U.S. Congress in midterm elections on November 8. Trump used Republican candidates as his campaign shield for 2024 election and failed. Many American people and media consider the former U.S. president as the biggest loser of this round of elections. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world press and news agencies to shed more light on the issue. Please stay with us to hear more about the details. The Hill newspaper reports, a new ballot shows voters and Republican operatives alike have labeled former U.S. President Donald Trump the biggest loser of the midterm election.